So, good morning, everybody. I should just say a few words about my background to get started. I'm an economist who got interested in crime, violence, injury, alcohol abuse, and smoking, and have been working in that variety of contexts since the 1970s. And with a particular focus on gun control and on alcohol control, as well as tobacco control. And so much of my research has been concerned about this kind of evaluation research of legal controls, and discovered only last year that I qualified as a public health law researcher. So after 35 years in the business, here I am, and I'm delighted to have this new identity and feel very comfortable with it. So what I wanted to talk about today, which I think follows very naturally from the presentations that you've already heard, is about a particular statistical approach to working with data on the 50 states over time. Panel data, and in particular to develop an example that I think was probably the pioneering example using panel regression methods from the early 1980s when I was working on this with George Tauchin. It's been very widely used since then, especially in the areas that I mentioned, but I think mostly by economists and public policy researchers and not so much in public health. And so this might be an opportunity for some of you to hear about this where you have not actually had a chance to try it. When I was doing research for my book on alcohol control, I discovered a terrific book that was written in 1933 by Fosdick and Scott, which also could be considered to be part of this tradition in public health law research. They were commissioned by John D. Rockefeller Jr. To help the states prepare for the repeal of prohibition. The states had never been in the business of alcohol control before, but all of a sudden here was the 21st Amendment that was going to put them into that business. And so Fosdick and Scott went out and did a lot of research and said, here are the options that are available in other countries, and here's how to think about this. But one of the things that they said, which I have always thought was a terrific insight, was, you know, you won't get it right the first time. Treat this in an experimentalist viewpoint, and this quote, the 48 states will constitute a social science laboratory in which different ideas and methods can be tested, and the exchange of experience will be infinitely valuable for the future. And so that this is the idea of one of the great strengths of the U.S. as a federal system is that we do have the laboratory of the states, and we have the possibility then of learning from each other in microcosm and then perhaps adopting it more broadly. So that's what they were suggesting and it was a good launching point for the method that I want to talk to you about. So let's talk about the restrictions that are take the form of minimum drinking age restrictions. The bit of history again, that in 1970, most states had 21 as the minimum age. And of course that was the Vietnam era where because of the war, because of the draft and the politics of the baby boom generation coming on, 18-year-olds were given the right to vote. That there was then a big push to accommodate this new group of voters, and one thing that happened was 29 states lowered their minimum legal drinking age by 1975, so that there was really a dramatic natural experiment that occurred during that time on the question about whether the minimum drinking age had made a difference, and if so, what kind of difference did it make? It's interesting that the expert opinion as of 1970 was pretty much that the minimum legal drinking age was ineffective or that it had perverse effects, that it would actually increase the highway fatality rate, for example, for a variety of reasons. All right, so we start in 1970 largely ignorant about the effects. We have a big natural, and then this creates the opportunity of doing an evaluation. And let me just remind you about what the goal is of this kind of evaluation. We have some outcome indicators such as the highway fatality rate for 18 to 20-year-olds. The treatment in this case, it would be the minimum drinking age. That is, it's the law. And then the treatment is defined as the difference between the actual outcome and what the outcome would have been if the law had been different. So in this case, the asterisk Y star would say the value of the outcome if there was no reform. It's a hypothetical, it's a counterfactual, and of course the big challenge in any kind of evaluation is to estimate Y star. Usually we know what Y is, we can observe that directly. What we don't know is what Y would have been in the absence of that legal change. And so that's what we're trying to get at here. So how do we go about doing that? Well, there's lots of ways of doing it. One is kind of the old standby, is just to compare states that have 21 as their minimum age with states that have 18 as their minimum age and compare the fatality rates in the two groups. So if you do that for 1970, before the experiment was performed, what you find out is basically the median highway fatality rate was about the same in those two groups of states. In fact, the states that had 21 as their minimum age was just a little bit higher than the states that had 18. So if you take that as the basis for estimating the counterfactual, you conclude no effect. It really won't matter if we lower these ages, and that'll be the end of it. And in fact, if you did the same thing 5 years later, you'd find out the states that had 21 as their minimum age had substantially higher fatality rates than states that had 18 as their minimum age. And so then you'd begin to push over to think this has perverse effects, is what it amounts to. So that's one way you can do the evaluation. It's kind of simple with and without analysis that uses the states. And of course the problem is that may well be biased because the states that choose to lower their minimum age or have 18 might be different in other ways. The minimum age variable may be confounded. And to handle that, we may try a cross-section regression that brings in a bunch of covariates. But let me say that it is never persuasive to do that. And if you just think about this a minute, you know, the ways in which the states differ that are relevant to the highway fatality rate include traffic patterns and road conditions and weather and the amount people drive and the amount they drink and traffic laws and on and on and on. So once you say, well, we're going to control for other things, what you're talking about is controlling probably for much more than 50 variables. And you only have 50 states, so it just doesn't work. So what can you do? Well, compare the changes instead. It's beginning to look more promising. And if we do that, we get this, which now in economics is known as the diff and diff, difference in difference approach, where we're comparing changes with in one group of states with the control group, a group of states that in fact did not change their minimum age during this time. And what you'll see here for this period, 1970 to 1975, is that the states that dropped their minimum age had very little change on average in their highway fatality rate. But the states that did not change, that stayed at 18 or 21, actually had a substantial reduction during that time. And so the counterfactual of holding the minimum age at the same level from this would suggest a reduction in highway fatalities. Why was there a reduction? If you remember back, it's the Arab oil embargo, the 55 national speed limit, and a variety of other things that were happening at that time. If we do the difference in differences, then we end up concluding that the effect of reducing the minimum legal drinking age from 21 to 18 was to increase the highway fatality rate by 11 per 100,000. And so that is a baseline, very simple calculation that we can do that begins to feel a little more credible. Now, what I did with George Token was to take that up another level and to do it in the form of a regression that actually used the 48 states. I think we dropped Alaska and Hawaii for some reason. But to go ahead and do the corresponding kind of analysis, but using a regression with all of those for the 8 years, 1970 to 1977. So it spanned this whole period of changes, a very dynamic period in minimum drinking age. We had a pretty good data set on minimum drinking age, thanks to Alex Wagner at the time, and so that we were able to code that without a great deal of effort or an NIH grant. And our dependent variable was the highway fatality rate for 18 to 20-year-olds, right out of Vital Statistics. We just spun the tapes in those days and got those numbers, and then we took the natural log of it. And very, very accurate numbers, about as best you can do. This was before FARS and that kind of thing, so we had to go that way. And then we had as independent variables a measure of the minimum drinking age. We just adjusted the number so that 0 meant 21, 3 or 1 meant 18, and it could take on fractional values in between. And here's the real deal, is that then we also included indicator variables for all 48 states and for each of the 8 years. And so each of the states and each of the years then had their own intercept in this area. We were able to control for all of that, and what did we get is a coefficient on the key variable about 0.111, and the interpretation of that given the log setup is just about the same thing exactly as what we found when we did the simple diff and diff analysis on medians, which is that the reduction in the minimum drinking age was on average associated with a 12% increase in the highway fatality rate. So whether this would still be true today if we could, the states decided to reduce their minimum drinking age again, who knows, but that's what it seemed to be then, a pretty reliable and robust result from many observations. Though the appeal of this approach is much broader than just in looking at the minimum drinking age. It shows up in a variety of health-related outcomes, which have these two features. One is geographic structure, an interstate structure that tends to be pretty stable over time. In highway fatalities, if you've worked in that area, you'll know year in and year out, Wyoming is very high, New York tends to be quite low, and for whatever combination of reasons, that's true. It was true in 1970, and I'm sure it's still true. The other thing that tends to be true for highway fatalities, but also a great many other outcomes, is that the states tend to share trends. There's really kind of a sense of a national trend. In the 1970s, it made a lot of sense because the Arab oil embargo affected every state simultaneously, and so that had a big effect. The 55-mile-an-hour speed limit was federal law. But year in and year out, in all kinds of variables, sometimes for mysterious reasons, sometimes for obvious reasons, the states do tend to have similar trends and serve as a control group for each other. So the panel regression, by including these fixed effects, then removes the geographic structure in a very flexible and comprehensive way, and the states do serve as a control group, taking out the time dimension by year fixed effects, but for the unique effects of individual changes in policy. And we can use this whenever we have a reform that is adopted at different times and places. For technical reasons, it's important that the reform not be a response to state-specific trends, which might well then create an endogeneity problem, which I'd be glad to talk about. The reform, then, this is responding to what Evan and Jen were talking about. Some of these reforms are multidimensional and hard to code. If you're looking at minimum drinking age, not so much. We pretty much can, I mean, there's some subtle variation, but basically it is what it is, and can very easily be coded, and then the outcome data are available for multiple jurisdictions, and public health data, vital statistics data often are. Okay. Let me just say, it's been used now, as I say, often by economists in a great many different domains. One of them is the minimum legal drinking age, and another of my favorite topics, the alcohol excise tax rates. And in those domains, my book talks about this, there's any number of outcome variables have been explored in response to changes in tax rates in the minimum drinking age. So it's not just a variety of injury and crime outcomes, but also STDs and many other things that have been looked at through this way. Powerful tool that has been applied by dozens of researchers and gotten us some reliable causal information out of this. Abortion regulations. Now, they tend to be much more complicated, but there has been an effort to code them and to incorporate them into this kind of panel regression study with the hope, with many years of data now since 1973, that it's possible to look at the effects of individual abortions. A project that I took on was the Brady Law, which was the law that required background checks when firearms dealers sold guns to individuals in 1994. That also was a bit complicated, but there it could be treated as either adopted or not adopted across the state, and so it was really a binary issue since the states that already had something in place were not required to change. So we had a control group, we had an experimental group, and we had a binary characterization of a fairly complicated law that worked out well. It turns out capital punishment is another area where, in 1975, none of the states had capital punishment, and in 1976, the Supreme Court opened the door to adoption. In 1977, 30-some states had it in place. And so once again, we had this possibility of thinking about the laboratory of the states and to see how this area then could affect yet another public health outcome, which is homicide deaths. And that's it. Thank you.
Thank you to all the presenters, and I'll ask them to come sit at the table while we take questions. Okay, so we are open up the floor for questions. Are there any questions for any of the presenters so far? Yes. Can everyone hear the question? It was about enforcement. Okay.
I can reject. So that's a great question, and we definitely acknowledge that there are other things going on with these laws, right? So I mean, today we're really just talking about the process of looking at the text of the laws and turning that into a quantifiable format. But something like enforcement would be just another variable that you could line up next to your legal variables. So you could look for arrests, so you could look at some other proxy for enforcement. The coding, the type of enforcement, so is it primary or secondary, can maybe get at that in some instances. Things like, is there funding allocated? So there are things that you could find in the law that might be suggestive, but we definitely acknowledge that there are other things going on out in the environment that are important to the law. So those can definitely be added.
Just add something to that.
Sure.
So I don't break my neck. The other, we have to think of this kind of study of law, which is extremely difficult, is also a kind of layered process. So this kind of initial analysis of just law on one side, essentially text, and outcomes on the other, especially if you get to the kind of methods that Phil was presenting, can give you a pretty important and good look at, you know, ignoring enforcement for the moment, are you seeing an effect? And if you've got enough variation, you can probably get a pretty reliable inference. But, you know, he could do that without an NIH grant. You know, this is actually relatively cheap to get that approximation. Of course, when you really want to dig into learning how to do it better, why some states aren't doing so well and other states are doing better, to really actually bolster your inference of causation from even a good quasi-experimental study, you have to understand how law is actually unfolding in practice. That unfortunately requires a lot of observation or the discovery of data that other people who are observing are keeping, like arrest records. So they're not exclusive, nor is this a panacea, but I don't think it's a really critical weakness of a well-designed quasi-experimental study that doesn't have enforcement data. That's just, you know, that's a limitation. We all like this question.
Yes.
Just the other thing to say, too, that one of the other points that we didn't get a chance to make in the time of our presentation is we're also really pushing to make sure that when you're creating these legal data sets that you're thinking about how it links with other sources of data. So using things like census tracts, FIPS, things like that, which will allow you to then link with other data. So it might be that there's language in the context of the law that talks about earmarked or funds that are dedicated for enforcement or implementation. Or when you go through and do your formal study, you may be able to then link with other data. So there may be, you know, budget data that you can link with it, but that way you can do it based on the state. So that's another really important thing when we're talking about our standardized methodology, is making sure that you think ahead, and when you create that data set, what are some core elements that you should be including so that you can link with behavior, you know, something like the BRFS or any kind of health outcomes data.
Angelique, do you have? Yeah. This is actually a topic that we give a lot of thought to in injury prevention law. Specifically, is the law even enforceable at all? And my favorite example is all-terrain vehicle statutes. All-terrain vehicle use largely takes place where illicit, illegal activity will elude detection and therefore elude enforcement because it's in rural, you know, private property all over the place. If somebody drives an ATV at excessive speed down a public highway, which is an extremely dangerous thing to do, the state police may not give chase out of fear that the driver will increase speed, therefore greatly increasing the danger of a lethal outcome. So in not just enforcement, but enforceability is a hugely important question.
Other questions?
Yeah, I mean, this goes to the point. You obviously have lawmaking at different levels, and this really goes to the importance of being clear about what you're collecting. And like Jed said, construct the database in a way where they can be linked together. And we're very clear. But you could apply the same methods to the local level too. Laws might be a little trickier to get, but it all goes to this point of just measuring the law.
Actually, since we have, it raises another point too, which I think is has been interesting for us, especially for me as a lawyer. I'm not really a scientist; I'm a lawyer, and so I learned that law was this very indeterminate, complicated thing. The law is a series of beliefs as well as a series of things written down. It's a series of behaviors, and if you ask, you know, I have a colleague who's always saying this to us: "You're not measuring law; you're just, you know, measuring some words." That's not what the law really is. And in a certain level, that's right. I mean, the first thing you have to think about when you start looking at legal texts And what we characterize ourselves as doing largely is measuring the apparent features of the law. And if you were going to go to court with the list of the apparent features of the law, you probably would not be treated very well, because that's not what they're interested in. But actually, if you want to have some consistent way of measuring the law, that's the starting point. You then begin to layer things on. And it is possible, and we're working with ways to actually make machine-readable data sets that include layers of interpretation, and start to get to more like trying to figure out what a lawyer would say about what the law is, among other things, by analyzing the initial features that you have discovered in a quantitative way. You have to be really careful when you're doing this to recognize that as a limitation. On the other hand, it's not, for many domains of work and for many kinds of laws, it's not really much of a limitation at all. And for others, it's simply one inevitable limitation that you can accommodate by doing further research of other types of quantitative research and implementation research and so on that fleshes out the rest of that. So, you know, it's like all, I think, pretty much all other domains of research. There is no one tool that does everything. I think our argument here is that thinking of the task as initially coding the apparent features of the law frees people to bring their scientific expertise into a domain that they had previously felt was perhaps alien to them because of these secret mysteries of interpretation. But also for lawyers, it disciplines them to distinguish sort of different elements of law and potentially to find actually more efficient ways to get the baseline understanding of what the features of the law is before they start to apply their legal mysteries to the law. Well, this is an important question. I'll say this first before Jen and probably Evan jump in with views on this. I think what we're doing now is going to make a big advance in the use of state law in research. But state law is different from local law in terms of how you find it in really important ways. For one thing, it's all available electronically. Whereas anybody who's doing local law research is essentially using the telephone. The resources of local law are uneven, incomplete, unreliable. They're not surely kept up to date. And then you get to the second question, which is so much of what you're interested in by the time you get down to the local level is not even really law. You know, it's not even the ordinance that says no food, you know, that you might have an ordinance that says the school district can't have an exclusive deal with a soda vendor, you know, as a way of getting unhealthy sodas out of the school. But practically speaking, you might actually have six school districts, each of which has its own policy on that, each of which is somewhat different, and that's what you want to actually get. So there is no easy way to do this. So in terms of, you know, that initial question, I think that's a big problem we all have. How do we get access to this important, crucial local information? But you had other parts of your question, and I'll...
And actually, this sort of piggybacks with your question as well. Just two responses. Number one, a lot of what we're saying here is, in an ideal world, here's the way it should all work. And what we're doing and what we did with this instance of distracted driving is we're testing that. We're saying, here's how it could work, and we're testing it. And so what I would say is, Julia has a presentation this afternoon at 1:30?
To 2:30
this afternoon, and issues like home rule and preemption. She's actually looking at what that means in terms of local legal infrastructure and the powers and authorities that local health officials have. So I would invite you to go to that session to see what it actually means when it's operationalized. The other thing is we started with looking at state law, and it's almost act one of we're not sure how many acts. There's issues with local law. There's issues with tribal law. in the 15-minute presentation, we didn't have time to get into the whole nuance of how you search for those things. But so we started with a state, and we are actually in the process of working with an organization to start to explore much more in terms of local law. So I would say, you know, if you go out to San Francisco next year to APHA, we might have Act 2 and be able to talk more about local law. How do you think about that? What are some of the different nuances, searching, and all that sort of stuff? So it's on our radar. It's just the state was an easier way to start. Evan, did you have anything to add?
I'll just say really quickly, I mean, I think one of the underlying challenges you're sort of tapping into there is this idea that you're interested in a policy that's comprised of different sorts of rules. So you might be interested in enforcement and penalties, substantive provisions, and they might be sort of scattered through the local law. And it could be tricky taking that constellation, sort of compressing it into the policy that you're really interested in studying. One of the benefits of the method of coding it is that you break things down into their single dimensions. So you ask if you can break things down into dichotomous yes-no questions or other simple ones. It becomes a little easier to make sense of that pile and then to that thicket of different laws in different places to track it over time. And if you incorporate, you know, a systematic way like an access database or some other way of using sort of informatics tools, which lawyers, you know, informatics for a lawyer is often a pile of papers on a desk, right? You can use these other tools that make it easier to do that reliably and to update it quickly. There are real economies of scale and efficiencies. So, I mean, really, one of the benefits is really breaking things down into their single-dimensional questions.
And part of our reason for doing it dichotomously...
You're not even on the tape.
Oh, sorry.
But we have another question there.
Part of the reason that we did it dichotomously also is that we hope that down the line folks will be able to, depending on the type of study that you're doing, you can recode it so it's categorical to address the question that you have, or hopefully down the line folks start thinking about how to create indices that would answer certain questions. So this was sort of what is the basic level that people can then manipulate for whatever purposes they need.
Okay, there are two questions so far. I saw you first, and then you'll be next. Okay, thank you.
I'll do the second question, and then somebody more reliable will do the first. I think the main this summer the IOM had a committee that issued a report on public health law and policy and public health, and one of the recommendations that they made was that CDC or somebody undertake an effort to experiment with what we're calling policy surveillance. Now, you know, in the argument was we track all sorts of important health indicators. We think, at least in some domains, law is really important, but it's very hard to find out what the law, you know, what's happening with that at any given moment, let alone the progression of events over time or the change in policy over time. The reason it hasn't been done in the past is how expensive it's perceived to be to do this kind of research. To get a 50-state data set, and that's why outside of a few well-funded areas like smoking and alcohol policy, you just don't get anything that's like that, an ongoing tracked policy surveillance tool. What you get is somebody does a study once and they may post the results online, but it's dead on arrival. It's just a cross-section of the law at some moment. Very difficult to reproduce, no indication of how it was made. All the stuff that Evan talked about trying to create a protocol that actually guides you through the entire process of doing the research, memorializing what you've done that produces the right result, using interfaces for coding and so on that allow rapid input of the data, that allow reliability checks, that allow, as you go forward in time, to compare the new data with new coders with the old data from old coders, all the standard things you do to make sure you're doing good work. Well, that we have actually done it and found that with law students who we used to spend all summer to do a small amount of work, we can spend, you know, half the summer and get a huge amount of work done. And we can, the article that we put into AJPM on distracted driving, we told them when we submitted it, when you accept it, we'll update the data set. And this is a very rapidly changing area of law. Well, it was updated in 2 weeks once it was accepted. So we feel pretty confident that now it is actually possible to do policy surveillance. And so what we're pushing for is people to try it. Because I think that's one big way that we can start showing people, all the stakeholders who are actually interested in law, who go to these websites and get sort of pieces of the picture, to go to a place where you can access that data set directly, query it, look at the actual text of the law, look at how it's changed over time, look at trends across states, just so that the basic benefits of knowing what's happening that come with surveillance can now be included in law. The other thing is, Jen was talking about, if you think about the value of something as simple as FIPS codes in a data set, you know, there's lots and lots and lots of geographic visualization of health policy, of health outcomes. There's almost no law in those visualizations because the data don't exist. But the data is going to start to exist. I mean, we're making it, we want to make more, and we make it so that it can automatically be layered onto that under that data. So we hope that we could see a lot more engagement of law data and health data in ways that may stimulate interest among people in the same way that, for example, the county health ranking stimulates policy interest in its use of health data. So that's sort of how we're thinking that, you know, just by making this more accessible, both the researchers and the public, we can make policy a little bit more transparent and salient to people as they think about health issues. Now the scientific question.
And before we get to this question, I want to ask a follow-up to this, to your comments. To a epidemiologist who was interested in this area, how do you actually access the data sets, and how do you bring it into common data that you might use? You mentioned BRFSS. So what's the practical process of doing this work?
So why don't you answer that scientific question, and we'll answer that question. That's a good wrap-up.
Mm-hmm. So if 50 states just aren't enough for you, then there is one possibility which is was just mentioned, and that is to turn to the counties. The small counties are a real problem. You know, there's about 3,000 counties in the U.S., and the 2,800 smaller ones have very little going on in terms of vital statistics, but I've done a number of studies using the 200 largest counties, and even for rare events like homicide and highway fatalities, you actually get robust results, and that works out. I think a second thing to be said is that you can increase the power by having longer time series, and so if you're using the type of data that has been collected in a consistent way for a long period of time, like the vital statistics, then you can hope to have an extended time series. And the third thing, you know, even just the eight-year study I showed you for 48 states that's already doing, you know, about 400 observations, and so you're getting up there. The other thing, though, that I think is really important in this area is to have as sensitive an outcome measure as you possibly can. And so if you're studying highway fatalities, for example, then you're interested in drinking, then you might refine it by saying, well, you're going to look at times of day and times of week when drinking is a particularly important part of the picture. And so that use a subset of all fatalities just to have the most sensitive and high impact possibility that you can do. So it's always kind of an art about increasing power, but certainly there's been many, many applications in which it's been plenty powerful enough to use these panel regression techniques if the intervention really did something. And of course, if it doesn't, then you can't find it.
Thank you.
as Julia reported, there aren't that many of these data sets out there. Some of them you have to pay for, like the ANR tobacco data and so on. We are pushing for an ethic of open source legal data. Anything that we fund is going to show up on the web, probably on our website. We already have the distracted driving data set and codebook and protocol available on our website, so you can go look at that, and we're going to have more data sets that we funded come on as they get finished. We expect an obesity law, a data set of childhood of legal interventions related to childhood obesity to come on in January, and then we're going to have some vaccination data sets coming on, vaccination exemption and so on. But, of course, the main thing is to get more people to start making them besides us and our grantees, and to find new ways to share them. I think there's some work to be done in terms of the industry or the field in coming up with agreed-upon standards and approaches to this, and teaching each other. And you know, right now we're kind of doing it mainly on our own, but I think that as more people do it, there'll be more to discuss about exactly how to make it available. However, as I say, you can go to our website. There is a tab up there for research and methods, and you can then find a data sets page and play around with what we've got. We also provide technical assistance in doing the work, including help with the various options for the coding interfaces and how to make them. They're actually not all that hard to make, says I, but Evan assures me that's true. We're happy to help any of you who are interested in do that.
The only other thing I would say is, as Scott said, we have a variety of additional data sets that are coming on board from our grantees, both our regular call for proposal grantees and our rapid response grantees. I would encourage you to stop by our booth, and we can talk more about what's coming up. But the other thing is, if you go onto our website, publichealthlawresearch.com, you can see what rapid response grants are out there that we don't have the data sets yet, but you'll get some sense of when they're going to be coming in. Typically, from the time we fund them to the time we have the data sets in hand is about 8 months, so you can see what's coming along, and also sign up on our on the website for our newsletter. As these data sets become available, that's how we disseminate and let folks know that they're available. You can go on and just click and download it. There is an agreement. It's basically for us to get a sense of how many people are actually using our data and how useful it is. But again, we are trying to be as transparent as possible so that if you're using our codebook, our protocol, particularly with the distracted driving, which we did in-house, we are more than happy to explain what we did. We also are starting to see that some of our grantees who have applied and also were working in-house to try to provide examples of how you link this, for example, distracted driving database with FARS or any other health outcomes data. So as those things become available, you will start to see more methods modules, or in whatever method, we try to be cutting edge in terms of technology, but try to demonstrate here's how you can do it in a very clear and transparent way. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Please join me in giving our presenters another round of applause, please. And thank you so much for your time and attention today. That concludes our session.